Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
All right, I'm Mark Hummel, and this is Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party, and we're sitting here in Occidental, California with somebody I've known for many, many years, Nick Gravanitis.
Yes, and grab your 90s.
Yes, did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. And Nick was born in October 2nd, 1938, and you just celebrated your 84th birthday.
Correct. Very good, Mark.
Yes, my memory still works just a tiny bit. And we're going to just talk to Nick about his long career and a lot of the people that he has outlasted. And we're going to talk about songwriting and Chicago blues and Chicago to California, because I think that's a fascinating story. Since so many of you guys, you were literally, as I recall, you were the first of the crew that you were hanging with in Chicago to really make it out to California, weren't you?
Yes, 1959.
Wow. Now, was that with Butterfield or was that before?
No.
That was by yourself.
That was with my friend, Ben Muscovich. He's now a retired philosophy professor down at San Diego State. But back then, he was a student of philosophy at the university, and he had a car.
Mm-hmm.
He had a 54 Ford with a thunder clutch. I don't know if you know what that means, but...
No, I don't.
Oh, well, it's
just you guys just deadheaded it out? Did you stop on the way?
Well, anywhere? I was at that time living at the University of Chicago at the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity house. That was a notoriously wild fraternity house. I think Animal House was patterned after that fraternity house. It was
that
wild
could be.
Period of time, history at Chicago, you know.
Do you guys have toga parties?
No. We had drunken brawls, you know.
Drunken brawls.
Yeah, because we had people at the university, and they would steal out of the hospital these 5-gallon carboys of grain alcohol.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And we mixed that with various things.
So what proof would that be?
180.
Wow, that's serious.
They use that to clean instruments with.
Wow.
They do. It dries and there's no residue.
That can't taste good.
You have to mix it with sherbet and ginger ale.
You'd have to mix that with something.
Everything.
Yeah.
Just dump it in, you know?
Right. It's not down the old hatch, is it?
No, it was wild. I remember the next day.
Uh-huh.
Went down there and looked into that. It was in a zinc garbage can.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it ate all the zinc off of it.
Jesus.
It was this shiny thing floating on top.
Unbelievable.
Oh, I know it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was crazy. But we were all nuts then, you know, and it was a weird time at the university.
Yeah. Now, was your friend kind of a beatnik?
My friend.
Your friend that you drove out to California with?
No, he was a
student. He was just a philosopher.
Philosophy student.
Right.
And he had beautiful feet. He was in love with his feet. He thought they were the best looking feet on earth.
I wonder what they look like now, don't you?
Oh, he was a good guy, a sweetheart. And we drove out to California, and we spent, I don't know, a couple of weeks out there until we starved our way out of there. We tried to get work, no work.
So did you go straight to San Francisco?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why stop?
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I drove over the Golden Gate Bridge. I was so freaked out.
Yeah.
Look how big it is.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's
the towers,
amazing,
how
amazing
tall they
thing.
Are.
Yeah.
And a at that time, it was the peak of the post-beatnik era in North Beach. And I had read all about it, Jack Kerouac, On the Road.
Right.
I would look for the names of these places that he mentioned.
Did you meet any of them out here?
Them.
I mean, like the beat people? Like
some.
Ferlinghetti or Ginsberg?
Ferlinghetti was always around. He had the bookstore. I did meet Bob Kaufman.
Okay.
Who was a real crazy son of a bitch. Yeah. North Beach guy. Got burned out on speed. And I knew some artists and stuff. Uh-huh. Michael Bowen.
Right, yeah.
But the university at that time, 56 when I went,
mm-hmm.
it was school in transition.
Mm-hmm.
It just come off of a period called the Hutchins era.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Hutchins school down in San Diego. He was quite a famous educator.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time was the youngest chancellor of university anywhere in the country.
Wow.
He's a young guy, 34 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought in all these strange, to them, rules. He wanted to recreate the university. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
He eliminated all the qualifications for entrance.
Wow.
If you want to answer, you answered. And if you passed, you're in.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah.
No nonsense, you know. And they had a graduated admission system so that you took a comprehensive exam before you entered the university to see where you were at.
Wow.
And they would grade you. Now, if you were a brilliant mathematician as a kid, as a 16-year-old genius.
Right.
They recognized that, and they'd start you off in your junior year.
Wow. And that's really unusual.
Yeah, and they do that. They place you the university at the level which you were effective.
Mm-hmm.
Some went right to graduate school. And it was children.
Yeah.
They were boy geniuses, girl geniuses.
Right.
Applying for the university, because they could.
Yeah.
Where else could they do it?
And this was in Chicago.
Yes.
At University of Chicago.
South Side, baby.
Yeah.
Hyde Park.
Hyde Park, yeah.
That's right. That's Obama territory now.
I've been there.
No, it was quite a strange area to be living in.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to go to class. That was not a requirement.
Wow.
The only requirement was the comp exam at the end of the year.
Right.
And that was your grade.
Right.
You didn't have to be there.
So did you get your, you graduated from, did you? Tell me the truth.
That's a joke. No, I was trun out.
Right. Because I know Elvin Bishop said kind of the same thing. He just dropped out.
Yeah. Well, I was supposedly thrown out.
Were you?
But they didn't have any evidence.
No evidence.
No evidence, but they
couldn't
did
convict
it
you.
They did it anyway. That's all right. I was in the wrong place.
Right.
Eventually, I wound up on the north side,
mm-hmm.
where the action was.
And you grew up where in Chicago? What was the name of the area?
Brighton Park.
Brighton Park, okay.
Which is right next across the river, Chicago River, from Bridgeport.
Okay.
Which is Daly's neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And so I lived on 35th. Daly lived on 36th.
Wow.
Daly lived on Emerald.
Yeah.
Of course.
Pretty
Irish.
Close, yeah.
You know, so.
Now, was your neighborhood pretty mixed in terms of ethnicities?
You crazy, back then? We're talking in the 50s.
Yeah.
Nothing was mixed in Chicago in the 50s.
Right.
Just a couple places.
Yeah.
Around the university.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a university and they had a lot of foreign students.
Right.
So it was mixed housing all around the university. And the only other place was on the near north side around the entertainment section down there.
Mm-hmm.
Where the head shops and all that stuff opened up. And
right.
That
in
kind
the
of
60s,
action.
Yeah.
Clubs and stuff.
Right.
That's where the best blues club on earth was.
Yeah. Big John's.
Big John's, right down there.
Right. Now, was Mother Blues down there too?
Yeah, Mother Blues.
Mother Blues and
Second City.
Right.
Right down the road.
Right.
It was all right there. There were other places around the corner. Yeah. And eventually, me and my partner and friend, Jeff Spitz, opened a nightclub there called The Burning Bush.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right, you're right around the corner from the other places. So it was kind of nuts.
What was the club that Bloomfield was booking for a minute that was just a coffee house? Fickle Pickle?
Fickle Pickle. Yeah, that was Michael's entry into folk music.
Doing shows, yeah.
Well, Michael was a special character. I could go on and on about him, but you know, this is about us.
And you guys were, you're about, 10 years older than pretty much that whole crew?
Yeah.
Yeah.
8 to 10, yeah.
Right.
I had 10 years on them.
Yeah.
I felt it, you know, I felt I was the older guy.
Right. You're kind of, in a sense, you were almost their mentor.
And they looked at me, up to me.
Looked up to you. Yeah. Yeah. And you apparently met all the blues guys prior to them meeting people like Muddy and so on, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
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 Did you meet them in the 50s?
No, in the 60s.
In the 60s, okay.
In the 50s, I was still a hoodlum.
Uh-huh.
With a brain.
A bright hoodlum.
Bright hoodlum.
And you can go a long way like that.
I know. Look at now, the contemporaneous situation.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of bright hoodlums out there right now.
Yeah. Well,
they're all in the GOP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no. They, everybody in Chicago, I thought, was a crook.
Right.
Because of the tradition.
Yeah.
Capone.
Yeah.
This was Capone's
Daily.
Town. Everybody was a crook.
Everybody,
And the only way you could make any money was to be a crook.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this or that, gambling?
That's not a good example, is it?
No. Capone, first of all, the black people in Chicago, they loved Capone.
Yeah.
They loved him.
Now, why was that?
He put him to work.
Right.
Either tap dancing, playing in the band, sweeping, serving, cooking.
Right.
He hired them all.
He gave them jobs,
He gave them all jobs. Al Capone, they loved him.
Now, how about Daly? Did Daly give him work or not really?
No. Daly was a stone-out racist, like me and my friends. We were all racists then.
Were you?
Oh, yeah.
So what changed that? Getting to
life.
Know them? Getting to know them.
No, life changed. That's all.
Yeah.
That's the way I was raised. I was raised in a racist neighborhood.
That was pretty much the general.
There were no black people in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
None.
How is it you ended up hanging out in black clubs then?
University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I went there. It was
changed
right
you.
There in the South Side, in the middle of the best blues clubs. In Chicago.
Right.
It was right there. Hyde Park was a pretty crazy neighborhood. See, Butter and I used to hang out in Hyde Park. He lived there.
Right. I knew he was from there,
Yeah, his family was from there.
Right.
He was raised there. He went to Hyde Park High, you know.
Now, how old was he when he started playing harmonica? Do you remember?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Hmm.
I remember how old he was when he started playing with me.
How old was he then?
16, 17. Yeah. He was a kid. I'm living there on 53rd Street in the same rooming house with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He had the room next to me.
Uh-huh.
It was crazy. It was the landlady, Vicky Kokoris, and then there was Karen Stern, who was an artist living in the front room. I lived in the room next to her. Then there was a bathroom and then Butterfield's room. Then down the hall was Vicky, the landlady. That's where we lived.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw him every fucking day.
And how did you meet him? What was that?
How did I meet him? I met him at the University of Chicago Folklore Society, Wingding, Hootenanny.
Huh, okay.
There's a difference, you know.
Between Wingding and Hootenanny?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What is the difference?
Hootenanny is when everybody gets together and sings the songs together.
You know? Okay. Interesting.
And a wing ding is when individuals.
Okay. So I guess we're going to have to rename our Hootenanny to wing ding.
Yeah. Hey.
Because we're calling it a Hootenanny, and I guess it's not officially.
Hey, I'm trying to be historic here.
No, you know? I appreciate that. I've never heard wing ding before. So you got into the Folklore Society?
Yeah, that's...
And that was that in the 50s or early 60s?
No, 1956.
56.
That's when I went to the university.
Right.
And everything resulted from that. And that's when I first started bumping into black and brown people.
Uh-huh.
There, at the university. I didn't know any others.
Were they in the Folk Society at all?
No, they just lived there.
Just lived there, yeah.
Yeah, there was their neighborhood.
Right.
I got to know black people that way. Mm-hmm. Just friends.
Yeah. Did you introduce Butterfield to that world, kind of, would you say?
We used to travel around together, Nick and Paul. I'd sing, play guitar, and Paul would play harmonica and do some singing.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go up to the universities and do Hootenannies, wingdings there. Madison, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Went up there and did a gig.
So there was kind of a circuit of Folklore Society.
Yeah. And also we went up to Ann Arbor, up to University of Michigan up there in Ann Arbor.
Yeah,
we played up there.
Yeah.
We almost got arrested there.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. We were hiding around on the campus before so it would get dark and they wouldn't recognize us. We wound up playing. That's where I met Billy Roberts. Do you know who he is?
Now, is he the Hey Joe guy?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's the Hey Joe guy. Exactly. Very well done. I met Billy there.
Did you?
Yeah, me and Butter were downstairs in the bathroom, downstairs behind the stage. This was a huge stage.
Yeah.
And a huge downstairs.
Yeah.
So we're down there in that back room because we're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we like the acoustics with the tile and everything.
Right, right.
The door opens up. There's Billy Roberts' face. He says, "What's going on in here?" And that's how I met him. But he went nuts, and so.
Did he?
Yeah.
Did he end up out here?
Oh, yeah, sure.
He ended up in San Francisco?
Oh, yeah. He played around.
Yeah.
Sure, I've got videos of him and I play together at the old Waldorf.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
This is part two of Nick Gravenitis on Mark Hummel's Blue Harmonica Party. And we're talking about Billy Roberts and Ann Arbor when he walked in on you and Paul Butterfield. And was this in the 50s or was this in...
60s.
60s.
About 60, 61. I'm vague now.
Yeah. Do you remember how you got your work, like, in these folk societies? Did you call them up or did you have an agent that would do it or...
We were getting to be known as a hot little duo.
Oh, okay.
We used to do this Nina Simone song called Flow Me La. Flow, flow, 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 flow me la.
Man, you guys were hip back then, weren't you?
Well, I'd do the guitar.
Damn.
And then Paul would do the harmonica.
Hip to Nina Simone, man.
That's how he started with improvisational on weird themes.
Right.
On that song.
Exactly.
Play,
yeah. See, now I heard the same thing about East West, that you kind of came up with that concept of that song. Is that true?
Yes. I wrote a song called It's About Time, and that was the basis of that.
Uh-huh.
And when I played with Bloomfield in 65 or something, we worked that song out. And he would improvise on the instrumental.
Right.
And that's how East West started.
Kind of get into the almost Indian raga type stuff.
Yeah, he was like, that's how that started, East West.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, it was like you guys were not just traditional blues guys. You guys really went into a lot of different avenues of music.
Well, that's folk music for you.
Because of folk music.
Yeah,
yes,
we did all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
We did songs from the Boer War.
Really?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we are marching to Pretoria. Sure, we do that stuff.
Are you pulling my leg on?
No. We do all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
We did flamenco.
Did you? Well, I think that was one of the things that kind of probably made you guys so popular when you came to the San Francisco area.
Well, I don't know.
Adventurous, I should say.
Well, that was Butterfield and Bloomfield.
So you were doing Nina Simone songs at some of these folk societies.
Yeah, and Paul would do these long instrumentals, and that's
how. Oh, really?
How,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, da 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 da. You know,
interesting.
Doing
so
his
yeah, that's interesting.
I love Nina.
Yeah, she's
her
awesome.
Earlier, first album.
Oh, she was awesome. She had that really wide range of songs that she would pick.
Well, the first time I heard her do Little Liza Jane. You ever heard her do that?
I don't think I have.
Well,
I'll look
you
it up.
Better.
I will look it up.
Because that, to me, was the first folk rock
right
ever. And I can't remember the guitarist's name. He was a real great, played what I consider modern folk guitar. He could do anything.
Yeah.
He was good.
Yeah.
He had a feel for it. I remember that. I was like, man, that's the first folk rock I've ever heard. That was him.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how about somebody like Richie Havens? Did you guys know each other when he came through Chicago? Or
I knew him from New York.
From New York, okay. And this was mid-60s?
Had to be early 60s.
Early 60s, okay. So did you go to the Village and all that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was playing at a club called the Fat Black Pussycat.
I don't think that would exist today, do you?
It used to be called Fiend John's.
Ah,
okay. And then it was a Fat Black. And then Richie was playing there. I go listen to him play.
Yeah.
And over the years, we bump into each other. And
yeah.
Bullshit a little bit. We had a good time.
Now, did you play some of those clubs when you were still doing acoustic folk music?
No, I don't think I ever. Only once later with the Flag.
Well, you played there with the Flag for sure.
Yeah.
Cafe
other
Roma
than that,
whatever,
but no.
Yeah.
1963.
Mm-hmm.
I'm living in New Jersey. Lake Hiawatha, New Jersey. There was no lake there.
Just the sign.
Yeah, it was a good name for a town. Lake Hiawatha, there's no lake there. In fact, the only thing a town is famous for is Bobby Darin.
Ah.
That was his hometown.
Okay.
And I was living there with my friend Ira Nelson, but mainly his family, Max and Sonia. They were building a brand new store, wrecking the old one, building the new one next to it. And then Ira got drafted. So Ira called on me as a friend to come and work at his family's deli and liquor store in Lake Hiawatha, which I did.
Yeah. And he had you come from Chicago.
Actually, I came from California.
Oh, you came from California. Okay.
Yeah. Right after the time we were living in a commune in Monterey.
What do you remember what year the commune was?
It must have been 63.
63. Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know there were communes back that far.
Well, it was a strange. I had a friend.
Mm-hmm.
He's been dead for years, named Ambrose Hollingsworth. He was originally a beat poet from Greenwich Village, wound up on the West Coast, hanging out with the beatniks.
Right.
I knew him in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Bugsy, Todd Cazot, he introduced me to him as a metaphysician. I want you to meet my friend Ambrose. He's a metaphysician. I said, what? Watch you say metaphysician. Went over there, talked to him. He introduced me to the I Ching and astrological shit.
Yeah.
Carl Jung.
Right.
All right. Enough.
Welcome to that world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Metaphysician's world.
Right.
And so later, I get a call from Bugsy, Tom, and he said, you got to go talk to Ambrose and his wife, Arlene, and her baby daughter, Alexandria. And they begged me to take them to California with us. I was with my wife, who was pregnant. I did.
Mm-hmm.
And off we went to California. I drove them to fucking Wyoming. And I drove them up. I left them off. They got their driveway car and off we went. I didn't see him for quite a while. Yes, quite a while. He showed up at my house one day, out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
What's he want? There's this place down in Monterey. Bring a whole bunch of people there to start a commune. We all wound up going down there to Monterey, to this big house. We had three separate domiciles, and like 17 people all together amongst the three places.
Yeah.
We had a commune going.
Wow.
We have a meeting before dinner, if there was any.
Mm-hmm.
Try to get something going, get to work, food.
Right.
Food. We was fucking starving.
How did you get food?
Gifts. One guy brought by this fucking dead seal. Seal?
Ugh.
Ugh. You can't eat it.
That sounds awful. Yeah.
Can't eat the liver, it'll kill you.
Will it?
Yeah, vitamin
really?
A.
I've
yeah,
never heard that.
Overdose. Yeah.
Wow.
A guy named Patrick Cassidy. He was a beatnik guy from San Francisco. He had a history. Spent some time in prison. He was known as the Gentleman Bandit.
Wow.
He stuck up a bunch of places. They finally got him, put him in jail. Right. He got out, wound up hanging out with the serious beatniks in North Beach.
Right.
And then wound up going down to Monterey and Big Sur.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he established himself. He found a spot. He built a house out of what was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a brilliant house.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big house. It had the fire pit, the ceiling. I told you, it had a terrace.
Right.
He had a piano up there. He had trombone, a trumpet. One of his jokes was, at 4 in the morning, when the monks woke up, you hear the bells, he'd get up with his trumpet and his horns. He'd give me the horn. Play. And I says, how do you play? I says, well, he says, I learned from the Chinese in Korea. They just blow. Oh, okay, blow. So we wanted to harass the monks.
Bet the monks love that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was great. He had a bound edition of a Bollingen's edition of pressed plates, not bound, plates of Ramesses the Sixth tomb.
Wow.
And so I'm leafing through these plates, and I got a feeling that I knew these people.
Wow.
They were like normal, everyday people with a sense of humor. After we woke up the goddamn monks, Patrick, he wound up starting growing pot down there. And he had a forestry service called Tree Bones. Tree Bones and pot. And he's the guy that started the annual pot party down there.
Really?
The harvest party. And it was going great until some asshole put it on the internet.
Well, it wouldn't have been the internet back then. It would have been something else.
He put it somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Newspapers or something.
He fucked it for everybody. He stopped it.
Right.
Had to. Thousands of people were showing up.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Now, did you ever perform at those?
Not at those particular ones, no.
Mm-hmm.
Various ones around. I did some Hell's Angels gigs.
Right.
Those are interesting.
Yeah, I bet. Now, was that the San Francisco Hell's Angels or Oakland?
Both. I used to do benefits. One, they were auctioning off this Chocolate George, I think it was called. They were auctioning off his bike. He died.
Huh.
He got killed.
Yeah.
I had tickets, and I'm saying, please, God, don't let me win this bike. Because if you win it, you have to ride it out of there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't get on that bike.
Right, right.
So thankfully, I didn't win. Got out of there. Did one in the middle of the woods.
Uh-huh.
Out near Santa Cruz.
Right.
Someplace out there. Did a show for the Hell's Angels.
Right.
But I didn't have my regular piano player, so I got this guy by recommendation.
Yeah.
It was a mistake. The guy was a flake.
Right.
He kept flaking and flaking, and I kept getting pissed off, and I shut the band down.
Right.
That's it. I've had it.
Yeah.
This angel comes up to me and says, hey, what'd you guys quit playing for? And I said, I'm sorry, but this guy got me so freaked out, I can't play. I have to shut it all down. He says, what guy? There's a guy over there. He says, oh. He says, do you want me to take care of him for you? That's when I learned about playing for the Angels.
Whoa.
That question.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, right. Oh, no.
He's not that bad. He might get better.
Guy was going to kill him. Unbelievable.
So, one question I got, at that point, were you already living out here when you're doing those Angels parties?
Yeah.
You're living out here? So when did you actually make the Bay Area your home?
Well, I told you, I came out in 59 for a while.
Right.
I went back in 60, 61.
Okay.
I stayed around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Played at the coffee gallery, did folk music.
Right.
I went back to Chicago.
Right.
Because I always have to when I'm destroyed.
That's when you open this, right?
That's 65.
Yeah. You had that going, which is amazing. And the story you were just telling me about James Cotton playing at his first gigs at the Burning Bush.
Yeah, he formed his band
His band there.
It was their rehearsal place. They had a couple weeks empty.
Right.
So I said, rehearsed. They did.
Yeah. And that was 66? Right?
65.
Okay. So he was out of Muddy. He left Muddy right around that same time.
Well, the way Cotton told me, Cotton asked Muddy for a raise.
Oh. Okay.
And of course, Muddy said no.
Right.
But the way he said it, he says, I don't pay no extra money to some harmonica player.
Wow. Yeah.
And that hurt James.
That must have hurt him, yeah, because he'd been with him for like 10 or 12 years.
11 years.
Yeah.
10 or 12 is 11.
11. You're still sharp, buddy.
Oh, well, I watch the Antiques Roadshow.
So how did, and your buddy Gordon Kinnerly basically found the guys.
Yeah, he called
to make that band.
He called Gordon in San Francisco and told him what Muddy said. And Gordon said, let's form your own band. Mm-hmm. He says, I'll come out there. We'll find the people. You give me their names, I'll go get them. And he did.
Yeah.
Cotton went to Chicago from California.
Mm-hmm. You mean Gordon? Yeah.
Gordon.
Right. Did he pretty much pick out exactly who he wanted, like Luther Tucker on guitar?
Yeah, he knew these guys.
And Bobby Anderson and Sam Lay.
They were pretty well settled.
Right, right. And from what I understood, I think Cotton told me that Clay was actually his choice first, but Clay was still hooked up with Muddy, so he got Sam to kind of fill in.
Oh, that's Sam great. Lay. Fortuitous. Yeah. But that's how it all started.
Right.
Other things. Steve Miller Band started there in that club.
Did they really?
Yeah.
In the Burning Bush. Wow.
Yeah.
Too much.
They had a crazy band.
Now, who was in that? Was that Boz in there as well?
No. Boz was
later?
Still traveling up to Wisconsin.
Okay.
Up to Madison.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. He passed through.
Right.
Big jingle balls of fucking hashish. And he went up to Madison, and Steve stayed, and, there was some kind of a hassle. We went up to Wisconsin once to play a folk thing, and he played there. It was called Steve Miller and His New Music. Well, his new music was Steve and a bunch of tape recorders. I'm serious.
Wow.
That was it. That's the first time I ever saw anything like that.
That's crazy. So he had no band other than himself.
No, yeah, just different things he was doing. Holy shit.
Yeah.
That was weird.
That is bizarre. Butter was there.
Oh, it was crazy.
So now here's another one is Barry Goldberg. Did you guys meet? You guys obviously met in Chicago.
I met him briefly in Chicago.
Okay.
I hardly knew him in Chicago.
You knew him more when he moved out here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was Bloomfield's friend.
Okay.
Another Lanceman.
Okay.
Play the blues.
Right.
And he was a blues player.
Yeah.
It's all he ever wanted to do. Yeah. Period.
And did Harvey Mandel move out here about the same time as those guys?
Maybe sooner. I moved out in 1966.
66, okay.
This was after the Burning Bush.
Yeah, after Newport Blues, jazz.
Yes, after everything.
Folk festival, yeah. Now, you went with those guys to that, because you were there at the whole Bob Dylan debacle and all that, right?
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Even before that, where Joan Baez broke my heart.
What'd she do? Oh, you're saying she broke your heart when you heard her sing.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah.
God.
Yeah.
What a powerful voice.
She was amazing.
Emotional.
Just amazing.
Emoter. Oh,
I agree.
God.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, especially at that era in particular, man. So when did you first meet Bob Dylan? Did you meet him in New York or Chicago? You could have met him in Chicago, because I know.
I didn't meet him there, though he was there.
He did play there, yeah, because Bloomfield met him there.
Yeah, I know. Grossman.
Right, through Grossman.
Yeah. That's another story.
And that's another story. I was going to say you were
there. His club
gate
in
of,
Chicago.
Gate of Horn, yeah.
Gate of Horn, right. That whole story.
Right. Now, did you know Albert when he had Gate of Horn, or did you not meet him until later?
I didn't get to be friends with him or anything.
Right.
But I was in his club a lot, and I talked to him a few times, yeah.
Yeah.
He was there. He was accessible. When Lenny Bruce.
Right.
Got busted.
Right.
There at his club.
Now, didn't Lenny Bruce get busted a few times? He got...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Both out of that club.
Oh, really? Both out of that
club?
Yes. Okay. So, basically, you guys first went to... When you were hanging around with Butterfield, Bloomfield, and Elvin, you guys drove from Chicago to New York? Was that where you went first?
To Newport.
Oh, but you went straight to Newport. When did they do New York on that trip or not? Do you remember?
Later,
okay. And we were talking about Grossman and Alan Lomax rolling around in the dirt during the Newport Folk Festival because of the crappy introduction that Lomax gave to the band.
Right.
And then also Pete Seeger, I guess, cutting the cables on Bob Dylan when Butterfield's band backed up Dylan.
Now that I can't authenticate, because from Bloomfield, the axe was not on cables.
Okay.
The axe was on a log.
Oh.
That Seeger was demonstrating what real folk music was about.
That's even better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the truth.
That's even better. Oh, man. But you said that there really weren't a lot of boos. It was only a few boos, but people seemed to like it.
It was mixed. There wasn't any real.
Wasn't like people were
throwing boo field. No.
Yeah.
There was no boo field.
Right. But why do you think? Do you have any idea why he cut his set so short? Because he only did like four songs or something. Do you know why?
Well,
just didn't feel like it was being received well enough.
I don't know why.
Yeah. Right.
I knew they wanted to get out. I knew that Bloomfield was all speeded up and playing everything twice as fast.
Right. Yeah. Do you think Mike did that kind of regularly?
Well, you see that show.
Uh-huh.
Because I was part of Grossman's entourage at that time.
Right.
I drove Dylan to that gig from the hotel.
Oh, did you really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
He didn't say a word.
Really?
Not a word.
Really? So you think that was nervousness? How would you perceive it?
No, Dylan.
No idea. Yeah.
I heard later from Bloomfield
that
he had talked to Dylan before the show.
Right.
And about the greeting he might get.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And Dylan said, I'm going to shove it down their throats. And that's what he did.
And that's what he did, and that's what he continued to do pretty much. Because from what I gather from the band, when they went to Europe with him, it was the same thing. He was just relentless.
No, he didn't fuck around. One thing about Bob, music, whatever, is his character.
Yeah.
Now I heard a story about Grossman and Dylan in the early days.
Yeah.
When he first signed with Grossman. So he signed with Grossman. He went to Grossman's office and had a meeting. Mm-hmm. And at this meeting, Albert told Bob, he said, Bob, you know, that contract you signed with Columbia, you weren't 21. You were underage.
Right.
And that contract is void.
Right.
And if you want, I can go and Columbia and renegotiate.
Wow.
In other words, go stick them up.
Yeah.
And Dillon said, no. And he says, I know John Hammond.
Right.
He says, an honorable man. He says, I signed a deal with him. I'm going to stick with it.
And good for him. That's amazing.
And that's all you really have to know.
Right.
About Bob Dylan.
Right. Right.
You know, music, garbage cans. Who the fuck knows?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he's got a certain way of seeing things.
Right.
He's got character.
Right.
That's all you really got to know.
And eventually, from what I gather, he pretty much was fed up with Grossman at the end.
Yeah, Albert. You know, Albert was a thief. And he had Dylan by the short hairs.
Right.
Publishing.
Right.
That's where Albert got you.
Right.
Publishing.
Right.
Screw the other shit. Record sales. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
Publishing, that is money.
Yeah.
And Albert made sure he got that.
Wow.
You know,
so his estate's probably worth a boatload of money, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't Dylan just sell what he owned of it? Dylan felt burned.
Sure.
And drifted away from Albert completely. Went to L.A., became Christian or something.
Right. Got in a motorcycle wreck. Another one of, and the flag ended up with Grossman.
Yeah. The flag.
Mm-hmm.
What a joke.
You're saying because it was kind of, did you feel like it was kind of a prefab thing?
No, it was just anything having to do with Albert is a fraud.
Right.
We get together with Albert for the first time.
Right.
They called me earlier. They knew I was a local.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, Nick, you're from there. Find us a big house. And I'll start shipping. This is broken. I'll start shipping musicians out to you.
Mm-hmm.
Put them up in the house. Get ready for rehearsals.
This was in Marin?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cam Valley. I found this house through my real estate friend. It's a big house, 3-story, bunch of bedrooms. So I rented it. Nobody in the band was supposed to arrive for a couple weeks, so I had an empty house there. Well, early one morning, I hear a knock at my door. Open the door, and there is Roscoe Mitchell, Lester Bowie. These are the AAA,
okay.
The American Association for the Advancement of Colored Musicians. There's a Chicago bunch. And they were all jazz guys.
Uh-huh.
Roscoe, famous jazz guy.
Uh-huh.
Lester Bowie.
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Well, Lester was famous.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're at my door.
Mm-hmm.
Say, what's going on? Say, Nick, we had a gig in St. Louis. Now they arrived in a green Bentley, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah. They arrived in this green Bentley.
Oh, my God.
And pile out. Say, hey, man, what's going on? We're here to visit. How you doing? And I said, boys, you fell into it. I got an empty house.
Wow.
And they had all their instruments in the Bentley and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
So I drove them over to the place. They unloaded their equipment mostly. And then they repacked their instruments and we all drove out to Muir Beach, where they took their instruments out to the shoreline. They set them up and they played a concert for the Pacific.
Wow. That's pretty awesome, actually.
I know.
Yeah.
These were, and they stayed there for a couple of weeks. It was empty. They ate their beans.
Yeah.
They played their music. They traveled around. They had a fucking ball.
Right. Right.
They did.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of my better experiences.
But they were supposed to be part of the flag? That was the original?
No.
Oh, this had nothing to do with
it? No, okay. These were guys. Fire out chance guys.
Right, okay.
Lester and those guys,
yeah.
Roscoe,
right.
They were Chicago
right.
kids.
Right.
and they went to Chicago schools,
right,
which have had the best music departments in the country,
right,
in Chicago,
right.
And they all learned their, by the time they graduated high school, they were way behind bebop, jazz,
right,
all that stuff.
Right.
They were doing experimental music.
Yeah.
And really.
Yeah. Sun Ra type.
Yeah, yeah, their own, yeah, their own thing.
Yeah. Ornette Coleman or whatever. You know. Right.
He told me they did the concert in St. Louis before they came out.
And yeah. How'd they end up with your number anyway?
I knew from Chicago.
So yeah. The house that you had, that ended up being where the flag lived, didn't it?
Yeah.
That was the deal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that Grossman putting all that together?
Oh, he has the money and stuff, the yeah. power, but Albert, Michael was...
He was the one...
Shipping them out.
Getting them out. Okay. Yeah. And Michael was still in Chicago, or was he out here?
Chicago.
In Chicago, okay. And so is that how Bluefield ended up living here?
Yeah.
Yeah, as a result of that.
Of course.
And they had already played out here for Graham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'd already, Butterfield.
Butterfield, yeah. Yeah.
I remember talking with Graham and Michael about that.
Yeah.
Bill Graham loved Bloomfield.
I know he did.
He loved him.
I know he did.
More than liking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a son.
Right.
And Bill says, oh man, you guys are the greatest band I've ever heard. Mm. He says, oh, you're fabulous, weren't you? And then Michael said, oh, you ought to hear the guys that we learned from.
Right.
Huh?
He didn't know.
He didn't know. He says, well, I'll give you.
Yeah.
People like Hollywood.
Yeah.
People like Muddy Water.
Yeah.
People like John Lee Hooker.
Right.
Bill never heard of these people.
Right.
He didn't know any of these people.
Right.
He said, the man I learned from. These are the people we learned from. And here's the phone number of Muddy Water's manager.
Wow. In New York. Wow.
Bingo.
And he just started calling every day.
That's it.
Yeah.
That became the Blues at the Fillmore.
Right. So you had that mix of Chicago with the West Coast as soon as that happened.
I guess, yeah.
Pretty much.
But it turned out Bill Graham loved it. Oh, wow. Now he had a whole roster of bands.
Rush.
Because he was up against it in San Francisco.
Because of the Avalon?
No.
Or what?
Yeah, only three or four bands.
Oh, right. Not enough groups.
Yeah.
Right.
So they had him over a barrel.
Yeah.
So he screwed him. That makes sense. I'm bringing in Muddy.
That makes sense.
I'm bringing in Albert King.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, he did.
Interesting.
So the
blues guys really kind of added to his war chest in a way.
Yeah, way.
Yeah.
In a big way.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely a big way. That's how it got started. How do you think B.B. King got on TV?
I know. I mean, I know. I heard B.B. King drove up to that gig and he thought he was at the wrong place. So he saw all the hippies lined up outside and he was like, I don't think this is the place.
Well, those were the times.
Yeah.
They were interesting times.
Yeah.
I thought.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Did you go see BB when he first
played? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're in the back room where Michael and BB were there.
Right.
And Michael introduced him. BB, this is Nick.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. Pleasure to meet you. Blah, blah, blah. We're back there talking. Eventually, a later show.
Mm-hmm.
When Albert had come out to visit me when I was living in Tam Valley.
Right.
I had a little house there before I moved to my other house. Nice place.
Mm-hmm.
And Albert would come over and smoke pot.
Mm-hmm.
Because he knew I always had.
Albert Grossman?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He'd hang out and smoke.
Right.
And he said, Nick, I'm going up. I'm here to see Paul over at Winterland. He's doing a show.
Right.
I'm going to show up. He says, you want to come along?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Albert, I'd love to, but I can't. Mm-hmm. Why? He says, because bad blood between me and Bill Graham. Why? What happened? I said, we had a big tussle when Janis Joplin came to visit at the Fillmore, when BB was playing,
mm-hmm.
and the Electric Flag,
mm-hmm.
and He wouldn't let her in the club, threw her out.
Why?
And she ran off down the street crying. I'm up in the back room talking to Mike and the people there. Sunshine, that was Janice's good girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Came in and said, hey, Bill just threw Janice out. I said, what? Tonight? Why? Wait, I don't know why. You know, being an asshole like he usually is.
Mm-hmm.
And I started cussing Bill out.
Mm-hmm.
Fat asshole.
Yeah.
Throwing out some hippie crazy fire. But she's a fucking blues singer.
Yeah.
And she's part of my tribe. You don't throw her out of the place. Right. She came here to visit with her tribe.
Yeah.
And then someone points over my shoulder, and there was Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Standing there, listening mm-hmm. to her.
Yeah.
I turned to him, I said, yeah, and that's just the beginning. And I cussed him out some more.
Wow.
He looks at me and says, I'll get you for that.
Whoa.
And I never worked for him again.
Whoa.
Never.
That's heavy.
It's 30 years.
That's heavy. No, it's more
never worked for him again.
Yeah.
Yeah, real cutie pie.
Wow. So that would have been like 69 or something. 70s?
I don't know.
Well, she was dead by 70s. So.
Yeah, so it was early. Yeah. 69-ish.
Yeah.
But it was at Winterland.
Right.
It was a weird gig.
Was it?
Yeah, I told Albert, I said, listen, I can't call. So much bad blood between that if he goes off on me like he went on Janice.
Right.
I'm going to kill him.
Yeah.
And I had the gun to do it. I did. I showed it to him.
Wow.
45 dual aluminum frame with Super Bell fucking dum-dum bullets in it. You know?
Yeah. Wouldn't have been
Colt
much left.
Commander. Colt yeah. Commander.
Wow. Shoot
flame with fucking. This was the gun. So I told Albert, I'm taking this gun gig.
Wow.
Okay, whatever.
Damn.
But he told me, he says, Nick, don't worry. He says, I've got him so bad that even you would feel sorry for him. That's what Albert told me. Okay, let's go.
So what happened afterwards? I mean, you said you never worked there again. How come Albert didn't fix that?
I didn't ask him.
Oh,
I didn't care by that time.
Yeah, by that time you're fed up. Yeah.
Yeah, so
yeah.
I get to the gig. I got my gun mm-hmm. in a side holster.
Right.
Quick draw. Yeah. Right there.
Right.
And I'm there. Butter calls me up on stage to do a song. Oh, my God. Oh, my gun's going to fall out. Holy shit. So Bill had a toady named Barry. And he was standing there by the stage.
Yeah.
So before I got on stage, I took the gun out and I held it. I said, Barry, hold on to this until I'm off stage. And he took it. I got up on stage. I did my two numbers. I got back up. He gave me the gun back.
Wow.
Now, this is Bill's toady. You don't think Bill heard about that?
Yeah, he definitely heard about it. Yeah,
I know he did.
Right. So that cemented you not working there again.
I was ready to kill him. If he got down on me in front of my friends and shit, I was going to shoot him.
Well, it's interesting. He just said, I'll get you for this. And that was the end of it.
Well, I never worked for him again.
Yeah. So now, is that when you started working at places like Keystone in San Francisco?
I was with Michael when we were playing Fillmore West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the carousel ball.
Right, yeah. Carousel, yeah.
Yeah, we were playing around, you know. And Michael said, Nick, you remember the old days? We would probably find a nice blues club. We'd play and run all this bullshit.
Right.
I said, yeah, he says, you know any places like that? I just, I'd think about it. I'll go down to North Beach and sniff around because that was my old stomping grounds.
Right.
So I'm walking down Vallejo, and who do I bump into but Jimmy Moscoso.
Good memory.
His brother, Victor,
mm-hmm. a famous hippie artist, Victor right. Muscles. And his brother, Jimmy, was a bass player for Cleveland Wrecking Company. I saw him walking down the street, down the lane. We talked. I said, hey, man, you know any places around here, any clubs, you know, we can get something going. I can bring Bloomfield down and play. He says, oh, yeah. It's right down the street, a place called the Keystone Corner. Oh, okay. I went down there. We had heard Freddie Herrera.
Freddie Herrera, right.
And yeah. his brother, Leroy.
Right, right.
And they were both contractors. They did contract work. Mm-hmm. Leroy was doing some plastering in there. Yeah. I mean, I walked in, I talked to Freddie. I said, Freddie, I'm good friends with this great guitar player, Mike Bloomfield, we're playing the Fillmore. And he said, I said, listen, we'd like to come down here and play at your club. We'll split the money. He said, we'll take the door, mm-hmm. and you take the bar. Well, it started.
Yeah.
It started to do well.
People yeah.
started to figure it out. From that spot on, we got Alvin Bishop. He moved into the club. Mm-hmm. He had a big room, had a bed, stove.
Right.
Bathroom right there in the club.
Right.
He moved to that was where he lived.
Yeah.
He lived at the Keystone Club.
Mm-hmm.
And then his relationship with John Lee Hooker.
Right.
He brought Hooker down.
Interesting.
And then that's how it all started. And all of a sudden, boom.
Yeah.
It was blues central.
Right.
You know, that's how that started.
Yeah.
Michael.
Yeah.
An instigator. Well, Michael was a charismatic person.
Yeah.
Yeah. People wanted to be around him.
Yeah.
And he was. He was nuts. He had a lot of good fun with him.
Yeah.
I had great times with Michael.
Oh, yeah.
But the Keystone, that's how that got started.
Yeah. And then you guys started playing the old Waldorf not long after that, didn't you?
Yeah, we played the original old Waldorf. And then, I forget his name.
The owner?
Yeah.
Jeff something?
Jeffrey, yeah. Yeah.
Jeffrey.
Jeffrey and Michael hit it off like peas and carrots.
Right.
They did. They hit it off. Jeffrey said to Mike, yeah, I'm thinking maybe about getting into this place down on Visadero. I'm not Visadero, but the...
Oh, right. Front. Off Battery and stuff.
Battery.
Right. Right. Where the second club was.
And Michael said, absolutely.
Yeah.
Don't even think twice.
Yeah.
Just go ahead and do it.
That was a big room.
And he did.
Yeah, it was a big room.
He
nice
did.
Big room. Yeah.
He did well there. Mm-hmm. And eventually Bill Graham bought him out.
Aha. Okay.
That's what happened.
So Bill Graham pretty much eventually usurped everybody around here.
Yeah. That's what killed yeah. the scene.
Yeah. But now, you ended up in the band after she passed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How long were you in Big Brother?
Oh, not long.
Yeah.
9 months, something like that.
Yeah. And did you start, your production stuff was basically, was James Cotton one of the first albums you produced?
First album I produced was, I think, I did Brewer Shipley.
Oh, okay.
One Took Over the Line.
Right, right. That was huge.
We did that in San Francisco.
Right. How you've kind of gotten the inspiration for writing?
I was always creative with language
mm-hmm.
from my high school days.
Mm-hmm.
And I write to there. I write prose, poetry. Mm-hmm.
Poetry.
Yeah. I was good at it. I had a good teacher. He encouraged me. Teachers encouraged me through my life.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me.
Yeah.
Like when I got expelled from military school, I had to get a degree of some kind. High school.
Yeah.
There was a school in downtown Chicago called YMCA.
Hmm.
Michael Bloomfield went to that school.
Really?
And his friend Minsky went to that school.
Wow.
It was like that's where you send your kids because they got thrown out of school.
Huh.
So, and so it was there I met Mrs. Petrilli, who saved my ass.
Mm-hmm.
She made me her project because the stuff I wrote in her class, she really liked it. Thought I had talent.
Interesting.
And then I became her project.
Mm-hmm.
She was going to get me into the University of Chicago.
Wow.
even though I had the disciplinary shit and this and that, mm-hmm. didn't have the paperwork. She was gonna get me in.
Yeah.
And she did.
Wow.
Incredible. I loved that woman.
Yeah, I bet.
She changed my whole life around. She invited me to Hyde Park.
So what do you remember being the first song you wrote?
Song, It's About Time.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. Someone has mentioned that song to me just the other day, actually. So that's one we should do.
That was the original basis of East West.
Right.
I remember the first time I had my name on a record was Born in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
When right. I bought the record.
Right.
Had to have it. Went right. back, opened it up, written by Paul Butterfield.
You told me about that.
What?
You told me about that.
So that was yeah. instant theft.
Right.
Instant theft.
But they had to change it right away.
With East West.
Same thing.
Same goddamn thing.
Unbelievable.
I had to call them and cuss them out.
So did your name end up on East West?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, good. All right, good.
I wouldn't stand for it.
I don't blame you. That's horrible. And here it's the guy that you basically mentored.
I know.
Yeah, it's equally awful.
That was my introduction
to the music business.
The public business. Like, right. when I first signed a publishing contract,
right.
it was with Jack Holzman.
Oh, right. From Elektra, yeah.
Elektra.
Yeah.
I was signed to them mm-hmm. for like 4 years or something. And I remember at the flag at the end there, I had 3-4 months to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be out of that country. Albertson, no, we can't let you do that. You're going to have to sign over those songs to me.
God damn.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So I can hide them.
Jesus.
And we'll find a name we can put them under. It was Ron Pulte.
That's who ended up getting the name on there?
Yeah, that's who wound up getting the name on it.
Wow.
So everything having to do with Albert Grossman in business
was
there's a fraud.
Theft, yeah.
Deep, he figured out yeah. ways to steal from him.
Right.
He lied. Right. I thinking back on it all, I don't blame him.
Really?
Yeah. What else are you going to do?
You're just saying because of the business the way
yeah.
it is? Yeah. It was so loaded with that already.
Yeah, he was playing yeah. with all these guys yeah. were playing the same game.
Right, exactly.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, Albert, you know, he was a crook, but he was a smart crook.
He was a smart crook, for sure, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
he wound up with all the publishing.
And he
wound up with Dylan's publishing.
Wound up with basically, like, all the late 60s acts. I mean, of any name.
I know.
Yeah. You Guys and Butterfield and Cotton and
Joan Baez,
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
And the original, Odetta.
Odetta. Right.
Don't forget, he married her.
Did he really?
Yes,
I didn't know that. Yeah. Whoa. I remember the other story you telling me was the one about Butterfield, when Butterfield owed all this money to his band. And basically, Albert told him, I'll pay you the money, but you have to break up your band.
He says, no, I'll pay you the money.
Yeah.
But you can't give any of it to the band.
Yeah, that's just so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That broke up the band.
And he didn't want to.
No, he was yeah. crying.
He was crying, yeah.
Begging Albert.
Yeah.
Albert said, no, that's it.
That is so awful.
That's business.
Yeah, it is business.
I mean,
the fact is Better Days was a great band.
Yeah, it was.
It was a great band, but that's not the way to go about business. And I'm sure the story of the band has a lot of stuff like that in it, too. You know?
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, those guys, they're all junked out.
Right.
Yeah. One of the reasons Dylan left, they were all junkies.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Okay. Sure.
So give me an example, like something like Buried Alive in the Blues. How did you write that?
Stole it.
Why do you say that?
I stole the title.
Oh, okay. All right.
I was in the Keystone talking with Elvin at the bar.
Right.
And we're talking about the blues. Oh, this and the blues and that and the blues. And Elvin said, Buried Alive in the Blues.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I kept that.
Wow.
Still.
Yeah.
And I wrote the song.
Yeah.
That song made me a fortune.
Yeah.
even though
it's been recorded a few times, huh?
Even though I didn't sing, there were no vocals on it when it was recorded.
Really?
Listen to the original Janis album.
The that last, didn't have vocals on it.
The last song is Buried Alive in the Blues and has an instrumental.
Wow, I did not realize that.
Yes, and that instrumental made me a fortune.
Yeah.
A lot.
Now, is that the only song that you wrote on that record?
I don't remember. Yeah, no, there's a few probably.
Yeah, I was going to say. Now, how about Mama Lion?
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, yeah.
Mama Lion. Go get yourself, Mama Lion. Mitch to me, Mitch to me.
Let me ask you something about your writing. What your practice was with writing. Did you write, like, were you one of these people that wrote, like, once a week, or?
No, I was an improvisational writer.
Uh-huh.
I like to improvise.
Yeah.
Do songs that I don't even know how they're going to finish.
Right.
Just do them. Just yeah. do them.
Kind know? Of the Van Morrison.
Well, not totally. I'd revise some
songs. He kind of apparently does
it. I go through yeah. periods of writing and mm-hmm. editing. And,
yeah.
And then I wouldn't. You know, so there's no set way. No set way.
Yeah.
You know, you could be walking along the trail and burst in a song.
Right.
I don't know why.
True. Yeah. Where does it come from?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Though I did have an out of body experience.
Now, what was that?
Chicago.
Uh huh.
This was a basement apartment, Chicago, a big yeah. apartment building. And it was a giant place, walls 5 feet thick. I put on my record player, listening to Lightning Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm listening and lying there in bed. And all of a sudden, I was looking at myself. My consciousness was up in the corner of the room. I was looking down on myself. Holy cannoli.
And this is before you were dropping acid.
No, this was totally on the match.
Right.
And it freaked me out.
Yeah, I bet.
I was there staring at myself.
Yeah.
And I saw myself,
mm-hmm.
which most people can't do.
Right.
I had a vision of myself. I didn't like what I saw. I said, Jesus, it's just the way I'm going to wind up. Dead on his bed, you know? And I had what they call cosmic consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I had that.
Yeah.
And I knew where I sat in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I woke up.
Yeah.
Started waking up, lying in bed, breathing difficultly. And then eventually I came out of it and got up.
So do you think you almost died?
It's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I could yeah. have had a heart attack.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I could have died.
Yes. Yeah.
I felt I could have. But that changed my whole life.
Right.
Quit my job at the restaurant. Assembled my goods. And I decided that was it. I'm going out to California to be a folk singer, period.
In AA, we
even
call,
if I have to die.
Yeah. In AA, you would call that a spiritual experience. No, seriously.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. That was
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I had cosmic consciousness. I yeah. knew where I stood in the universe.
Right.
So, packed it all up. I went out. I got a couple of clothes hampers, cheap ones. I filled one up with half gallons of gin. The other one with half gallons of vodka. And I had me a half of a mason jar of cut reefer. And some Bennies. And I drove out to the West Coast. 61 is when I did this.
Right.
At North Beach.
Right.
Which is the center of Beatnik.
I remember the coffee gallery very well, man.
Yeah, that was my spot.
That was a great spot, yeah.
Used to go there and play
Yeah, it's still there, but it's called something else now.
That guitar over there.
Really? Yeah. That same guitar?
The same one.
What is that?
It's an old Gibson.
Gibson?
Yeah.
Wow.
You saw the movie Don't Look Back?
Yeah.
That guitar that Dylan was playing?
Yeah.
That's it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's destroyed.
Yeah.
It's just an artifact now.
Right. That's amazing.
That's it. I used to carry it around. Never had a case for it.
Really?
I'd carry it around, rain and shine, over my shoulder.
Damn. Yeah.
He was a badass motherfucker, man.
I bet.
Folk music days, I loved them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't have to. Remember I wrote Born in Chicago?
In the folk music days?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I remember now.
So did you give that to Paul or Henry?
No.
Or,
no, did
he just liked it?
He likes it, he steals it.
Right, right.
Which they tried to do.
I guess Dylan did that kind of stuff too.
Everybody did.
Stealing songs.
Gross was a master.
Yeah.
Stealing whole publishing catalogs.
Right.
But no, I don't blame Albert anymore.
Yeah.
I used to, but not
anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Albert was a strange guy.
Yeah.
He died in the airplane.
Did he really?
Yeah, he was.
Heart attack?
Brain hemorrhage.
Really?
He was sitting in his chair on his way to Cannes. And when the flight was over, they tried to wake him up, but he was dead.
Wow.
Died in his sleep.
You know how old he was?
58.
Really?
Yeah.
Pretty damn young, man.
Yeah.
Well, he was definitely the center of it all for a while there, huh?
Yeah, he was. He was. He had a strange aura about him.
Did he?
Yeah, he had the power.
Yeah, yeah.
He was Dylan's guy. He was this guy, that guy.
He really tied his, the power broker and all that.
Just to be around him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, hang out with Albert.
What's your take on that kind of stuff, power, and how it affects people?
Now that I'm 84?
Yeah. How do you look at it?
Well.
Bullshit or what?
No. I look at it in terms of betrayal.
Betrayal? You mean betraying themselves?
Everyone.
Or everybody?
Everybody betrays.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've betrayed.
Yeah. I think if you're human, you do.
And Albert betrayed, Butters betrayed.
Right.
I remember talking to Dave Katz about Albert.
Right.
And his relationship to Big Brother.
Right.
And how I thought that Albert was a crook. And he said, no, he treated us straight.
Did he?
Yes.
So they knew what was coming, in other words.
Yeah. You know, when they broke up and this and that and this and that.
Right.
He didn't, Albert treated them straight.
Right. He didn't hold it against
him. You know, he tried to cheat him.
Right. Right.
Resentment, my ass.
Yeah.
Cheat him. Fuck resentment.
Yeah.
You know, what good is that?
Right. One question was when you guys did the tribute to Muddy on PBS.
Yes.
And you had, I think it was Butterfield, you, Bloomfield, Junior Wells, Dr. John, and am I missing anybody?
The bass player. Dixon.
Was Dixon on that?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
Really, Dixon was playing.
All right. So was that something you cooked up, or was it somebody else who cooked that up?
I don't know. I never cook anything up.
Yeah. Well, did Bloomfield have anything with getting that going?
Well, he always does.
Yeah.
He was a big name.
Right.
He was Muddy's boy.
Yeah.
He was.
Yeah. I got that. Yeah.
Muddy considered Michael a genius.
Like a son,
Like a son, but not only that, Michael could play everything Muddy ever did.
Right.
The way Muddy did it.
Right, right. And that's very special.
Oh.
Yeah, that's very special.
The way Muddy did it. Mm-hmm. And so on that show, most of the guitar playing was done by Bloomfield.
Right.
All the Muddy breaks, was Michael.
Right. Playing the slide?
Yeah, that was Michael.
Yeah, wow.
I don't think Muddy did one song or something.
Hmm. Might have done some bass lines or something,
Well, who was the other guitar player?
That played on that?
Was
it Johnny Winter or something?
No,
who was
he was there. Winter
was he there? Okay.
Another black guy.
Oh, God.
Brother.
I'm trying to think of who.
I don't know. You'll think of it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Was Buddy Miles on that or no?
Yeah.
He was. Okay.
Yeah. Buddy was there.
Right. Dr. John, I remember.
Dr. That. John, for yeah. sure.
Yep.
So we're in the back room, mm-hmm. hanging out.
Right.
Right. Buddy, me, Michael, who walks in? Buddy walks. Mm-hmm. Looks around, walks right up to Buddy Miles, points his finger in his face, and says, if you pull any of that bullshit prone on me, you'll never work again. You got that? Yes, sir, Mr. Waters. That's the truth.
Wow, I believe it.
Muddy's told him. He said,
I believe
fuck
it.
With me, you'll yeah. never work again.
Wow.
And that's exactly what happened. But
yeah.
he kept his mouth shut.
Yeah.
Played
wow.
his drums.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I thought it was interesting how, like, with the flag, you know, and you might have been out of there by that time, but that Bloomfield would get really tweaked by Buddy at the end, in terms of just the showboat thing, you know.
Well, he hated that.
Yeah.
Michael hated the showboat.
I can relate, man. I can relate.
Well, no. Buddy yeah. was nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I went with Bloomfield down to Muscle Shoals.
Right. Oh, did you really?
Yeah, you didn't know about that.
No.
Well, nobody does. Turn it on.
It's still going.
Nobody knows that.
I did not.
We arranged through Grossman a contract to record Otis Rush.
Oh, right, but that's right. The Otis Rush record is there.
Otis
yes.
Rush and
with Jerry Jamon on. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. You're right. So Dwayne Allman.
Yes, Dwayne. He showed up.
And Dwayne Allman would have been really young, right?
Yeah, he was young. He was hanging down at Muscle Shoals. Jerry Wexler.
Right.
Which is, he is right. lost
Atlantic,
out.
Yeah.
He took care of him. He got him gigs.
Interesting.
Stuff. Yeah.
And you guys also did the, or at least I know you did the Right Place, Wrong Time record by Otis, which is one of my absolute favorites.
Me too.
Yeah. That is such a great record.
It's one of the best I ever produced.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really a time capsule of Otis in that era. It really is.
Yeah, well, after a while, I got tired of producing because the producer became the guy who showed up with the cocaine.
Mm.
I just fucked that.
Yeah. Was Otis into that? I didn't know he was.
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so, yeah.
Yeah, we were down in Muscle Shoals, and they were doing Gambler's Blues.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So put their instruments down, got on the floor, and started rolling the dice.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
They were gambling on the floor.
They were living the song, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were there any of the guys in the Muscle Shoals band at that? Because I know Jamal wasn't from there, and obviously
well, they were
you guys.
All there, yeah.
Okay, so it was all the regular guys
yeah,
from Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, everyone.
All right.
Roger Hawkins.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson and all those guys.
Yeah, Jimmy was there. Yeah, they remember we're sitting there behind the studio, and
uh-huh.
and they were telling me stories about Rick Hall.
Right.
The guy
owner,
who owned the
owner, yeah. Yeah.
Says, yeah, Rick Hall, he was fucking, he says he used to take his sock off and roll it up. Ah, punk, he said, punk.
Sounds like me. Now I don't feel so bad.
So at the end, you know, we finished and we did this and that.
Right.
Dwayne Allman sat in, blah, blah, blah. So it's all over.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to the boys in the band.
Mm-hmm.
The boys in the band told him that they weren't getting paid half. They did two sessions and got paid for one.
Oh, my God. This is Rick Hall that did that?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the procedure down there.
Yeah.
You could imagine what Michael did.
Yeah.
He freaked out.
Did he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said, what?
Yeah.
They're paying you half. You guys are the whole reason for this place being alive.
No shit.
He says, you come with me to San Francisco, I'll introduce you to Bill Graham. You'll have an instant recording contract.
Wow.
You'll be famous in 6 months.
That's amazing.
And they're like, huh? Really? Yes, really.
Yeah.
Half.
That's incredible.
Michael made sure those guys got paid full.
Wow.
And so a couple of weeks later, they all quit.
Right.
They went across the street, opened up Muscle Shoals.
Right, right. The other studio, right?
The other studio.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. That's from Mike. That was Michael.
Yeah. That's a great story.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
Yeah. No, I can tell that. I can tell that. Nuts, but a great guy.
Yes. You're learning everything.
I am. I'm learning it all from the source, too.
And I haven't even started.
I know you haven't even started, but I know you're tired, Nick. So
I am.
I'm going to let you go. It was an absolute pleasure.
Mark, thank you.
You are a great storyteller, by the way.
Thank you.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.